see the idea of the return. Now, it's interesting to look at here. So commonly, the Pharisees are viewed as very legalistic hypocrites. Page 7. This is seriously flawed, but the best historical sources demonstrate that the Pharisees themselves condemned hypocrisy. As a matter of fact, the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls, who did not like the Pharisees because of their what?
Lenient
rules. Now imagine that when everybody thinks that they were the strictest of the strict, and then the community from Qumran says, we don't like the Pharisees because they're too lenient in everything they do. Page 9. So how does that affect your perspective of the Pharisee now? It changes it, doesn't it? Makes you know that, guess what? While we thought that the Pharisees were, number one, hypocritical, just like us, you know, you get in certain circles, you know, they point at that other congregation and they say, those guys over there, they're a bunch of hypocrites, right? Everybody does it, right? So it's kind of like the old cliche of the pot calling kettle black, right? But notice here now that there was another group that was much stricter than the Pharisees. So the Pharisees were really kind of a little bit more middle of the road with the whole process. They weren't as strict as the Qumran community, but they definitely weren't the Epicureans that the Sadducees were. Okay.
Weren't the Qumrans the Essenes?
Well, there's a difficulty there. Some scholars say yes. And some scholars say no, okay? And so there's a bit of debate whether they are or they're not. So to just kind of circumvent the argument, I just say that the Qumran community, right? Because the Essene community has particular things, and there are certain scholars who absolutely argue that they were and others that argue that they're not. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, not specifically, other than the fact that, you know, when you look at the community at Qumran, we have their literature, right? The Dead Sea Scrolls. We know how they lived and what they thought and how they structured their day, okay? Now, what Dr. Brad Young has done with this class, now that we've passed, or for this lesson, now that we passed our introduction, we just thought give you that little introduction before we go on. Okay, is he basically divides this chapter into three particular parts, right? Part, we'll just take them basically as I remember them. Charity, or acts of righteousness, okay? And then we have prayer. And the final is fasting. Huh?
Fasting.
Okay. So he divides the chapter into, in the particular discussion from Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, as it's called, he divides that into three basic categories, okay? The first being charity. So on page 9, we talk about charity. So let's just read this quickly. It says, we're in the book of Matthew here where it talks about Matthew. Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen of them. If you do, you will have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by men. I tell you a truth that they've received their full reward. But you, when you give to the needy, do not let the left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father who sees you in secret will reward you. Okay, so number one, the question here should be, is Yeshua condemning acts of righteousness or giving to charity? Is he condemning that?
No.
Okay, so then we have to say, well, what was he saying? What was he talking about here when he talked about this?
He said we should give to the needy.
Okay. But he was...
But not to brag about it.
Okay, not to brag about it. So, What was he addressing? What specific thing was he addressing?
Attitude
or motive behind giving, right? Mm-hmm. Because some people give, you know, when they go up there and they're waving a $100 bill so that everybody can see them when they put it in the basket, right? You'll say, wow, that guy gave, you know, $100 or whatever. Now, that can have an effect on you. You can see that, you know, the guy is either showing off, so to speak, or that, you know, now that because he gave $100, you feel like you should do what? You know, I mean, not that anybody would ever orchestrate such an event. Right? Do you understand what I'm saying here? Somebody could plant the $100 bill, put it in the basket. Everybody else feels guilty, so what do? Now, I used to go to a Pentecostal church. You know what a Pentecostal church is? No, Pentecostal, you heard? Excuse me. Okay, so he addresses here motive, okay? Now let's talk about charity just for a second. First of all, go to your notes, page 3 of your notes. Now that we've covered all the questions, huh?
The ones on prayer?
Not on prayer, the outline, the other outline. Okay, we'll get to the prayer one in a minute. Where it says charity, acts of righteousness. Okay, down below that we'll say about 5:13. Everybody see that? There are four traits among people who give charity. He who wants to give but does not want others to give, but he begrudges what belongs to others. Interesting, huh? He wants others to give but does not want to give. He begrudged what belongs to himself. Okay, what has this guy got in his mind?
He's selfish.
He's selfish. He wants you to give. He wants everybody else to give, but he does not want to give himself. He wants to hold on to what he claims as his own, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, number 3 said he will give and he wants others to give. He is truly pious. Okay, so has this guy got a genuine motive? Okay, let's look at the final one. And he will not give and does not want others to give. He is truly wicked. So of all of the choices, if you had to pick one, you would pick?
Three.
Number 3, right? You want to give, but not only you want to give, you want others to give as well because you're truly pious. Now, when we say pious, we want to say actually that this individual is righteous, but righteous also means that he's generous. When you find people who are authentically righteous, they're also generous people. They give. As a matter of fact, sometimes, several weeks ago, we discussed here in class the idea of the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov, and we said that those are both a part of our nature, right? We're made that way. That's the way God made us. He wants us to be made that way. But guess what? The Yetzer Hara can also be giving away too much of the stuff that you own. Right? There's no problem with giving. There's absolutely no problem with giving. But guess what? You know, we have to be sustained as well, right? So here, piety says, not only do I want to give, but I want others to give as well. Okay? All right. Now, we talked about that particular part of charity, but let me ask you a question. This comes from rabbinic material. Didn't look up the source. I will if you need it. Or actually, I should... Yeah, that would be a great job for you guys to do, wouldn't it? Okay? Well, yeah, the internet tells everything today. You just type in Google and you can find anything you're looking for, right? Some things you're not looking for. What is the highest form of charity?
Giving in secret.
Giving in secret. Brother Roger says giving in secret. Does everybody agree? So in other words, Brother Roger sees an individual who has a need, but he, out of true piety, he does not want this individual to think that he's given the money so that he'll laud on Roger, you know, for doing this, and then, you know, the individual. Do you think that the individual would feel obligated to go thank Roger if he knew that Roger gave it?
Yes.
So if he gave in secret, then the individual doesn't feel this need to go to Roger and say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for what you're doing, etc., right? So is that the highest form?
So he'll thank God instead.
He'll thank God instead. Very good, very good. Is this the highest form of charity? And technically in Judaism, that's not acceptable.
If you give, if you see a need, this might conflict, have a conflict because of what we were talking about a few weeks ago with giving away too much. But like, if you see someone, you're wearing clothes, the proverbial shirt off your back, they have a need. You take the shirt off your back. Give something that you could use too, but give it genuinely, knowing that they need it more, even though you have a need.
So that's giving. So that's giving. That's giving it openly, but giving out a genuine need.
Well, it could be. It doesn't have to necessarily be openly. You could still use that principle.
Secret.
Yeah.
Secret method. But right, you see this individual. So in this particular case, you didn't say give the guy $100, but you had your favorite coat and you knew that was the real thing. So you said, you know, I'm going to give him my coat. But, you know, let me ask a question. What if this guy goes to the same congregation and he notices all of a sudden you're not wearing that coat and you had a coat just like that? Is he going to figure out that that's where it came from?
In that event, I probably wouldn't do that. I would find another way to get them. But, I mean, it's...
Go to the store and find one that you really did like, even though that you didn't have it, and then buy it for him?
It cost you something.
Very good.
Not necessarily cost you to the point you can't survive, but that, to me, would be the highest form.
Okay, does everybody hear what she said? Okay, does everybody agree? Brother Courtney, is your wheels turning back there? I thought you... No, not yet. Okay, anybody else have an opinion?
Widow's mite.
Okay, she gave everything she had. Okay, actually, rabbinically, all of those are valid and viable ways of giving charity, but none of them are the highest.
So then what is the highest?
Well, that's your homework. No, I'll tell you. The highest is to see that the individual has a need and then give him a job.
So he can provide for himself.
So he has a sense of self-worth in the process of earning money that he needs. So it's not just give him this, because he if someone gives him charity, this individual said, somebody give me charity because they saw I'm needy, and then all of a sudden he can have negative opinion of himself or whatever. But if you give the individual a job, he feels his self-worth, right? And then he goes to work and et cetera. But you don't give him a job and say, I knew you were in need, so you kind of do follow this secret thing a little bit, right? You know that he has a need, so what do? You put him to work, and then he has a sense of self-worth and he has a job and you're doing something to promote him. And everything is productive.
That's
exactly.
Kind of like teach a man to, you can give a man a fish and feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, you fed him for life.
Right, exactly, exactly. Okay, page 11 on prayer. Okay, did we cover charity okay? So now when you give charity, what are you going to do? Hey, I got some leaves in my backyard. Would you mind? I'll give you... Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. No, where it says prayer, it said, and here's your homework, okay? A question that's not in the homework, okay? These three things, charity, prayer, and fasting, have one common root. One common root, okay? Just in this chapter, and you should be able to find it in this chapter. Next week, I want to know what it is, okay? All right. I said, and when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by men. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees what is being done in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not keep babbling like pagans, for they think that they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. Okay, now let's just stop right there and ask a question about prayer. Okay? We have, all of you have the material. You could get this material out, the material from the Siddur. Okay? Most of you should know that Judaism prays through using the Siddur, right? Now, that does not mean that they do not pray spontaneously like we do, okay? But they also have a system by which they're designed to give at least 100 brachot, 100 blessings a day, okay? Now, in other words, to use the words of somebody else, I don't remember who said it, but he said, pray without ceasing. Didn't Paul say such a thing? Okay, what's the idea? To be constantly in communion with God all day long, right? So my question here is, Yeshua, who undoubtedly was familiar, not necessarily with the Siddur, but with the prayers that were being prayed systematically and routinely in the synagogue, is he addressing that issue here? Just from what we read, what do you think?
I don't think so.
Okay, so now you have to tell me why you don't think so. It's kind of like, you know, when you get those tests, they say, give an answer, then explain your answer.
Well, he's telling them, you know, not to just stand up front and pray, but to have a heart and, you know, I mean, to pray from the heart.
Okay, so number one, so let's say here, number one, he's saying, don't do it up there and do it really loud and boisterous and you know, try to do this really elegant thing so everybody looks at you and they say, wow, that guy can really pray or whatever, right? So he's echoing exactly what he said about charity. Right? He says, don't do this, everybody will see you. He said, because if that is your goal, your motive, then what?
That's your reward.
There's your reward. Everybody will come up, pat you on the back, and say, wow, you're so good at prayer. And then guess what? When he stands before God and he says, well, God, you know, what about, you know, the reward I get for all those fantastic prayers? He said, you got all that already. You know, I mean, you wanted people to pat you on the back? They did. So, you know, there's your reward, right? Okay. Is that all he addresses in this particular section here?
Yeah.
Okay, what does he address?
Prayer in secret.
Okay, then he said, guess what? He said, it's better for you to do what? To go and pray in your room somewhere. Okay, enter into a prayer closet, in some versions they'll say, or I think the idea is actually wrapping yourself in your tallit and being there and not, we don't care about who's outside or whatever, we're here. My point is that I'm going to communicate with God. Okay? So, it rather than being the spectacle of prayer, you actually get to the idea and content of prayer rather than being the spectacle, okay? So he says do this in secret, okay? And if you do it in secret, then you'll be rewarded for the prayer itself, the things that you ask, etc., right? Okay, now, is that all that he is referring to here?
Knowing you, the way you asked that question, of course not.
Val, you've been coming to this class way too long. Of course not, she says. Okay, look at here. We'll pick up on what Roger says. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Okay, so Roger's absolutely right. And
do not keep babbling on, do not.
Okay, so don't just jibber jabber away. A few years ago, I was trying to tell people in the class that they needed to become familiar with the Siddur, and that they should learn to pray particular prayers out of the Siddur. And had an individual, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying this because he came to class and said this openly in class. You guys may have been here. And I asked him to do one thing for me. And if you, and so I'll put this question to you, if for any reason that you think that your personal prayers, now please listen, I'm not saying don't pray your personal requests. I'm not saying that at all. But if you think that's the only way to go, then what I would ask you to do is get you a little notebook, and then on the outside of that notebook, put prayer journal. Okay? What I would really recommend is don't buy a big, thick notebook. There's a reason behind why I said that. Okay? But then, day one, do this for about 3 weeks. Day one, pray your prayers, and then try to remember all the things that you asked for and all the things that you said. Just briefly categorize them in your little prayer journal. Okay? Do this for 3 weeks. I ask an individual to do that very same thing for 3 weeks, and from one Thursday night to the next, he came back and he says, "Where can I get one of them siddurs?" And I said, well, why would you want a siddur? He said, because what he did was he did exactly what I asked him to do, was he kept a little journal, and he said it took him 2 days to realize that his prayer was vain and repetitious. In other words, he always asked God for exactly the same thing with little or no real motivation behind his asking. Just kind of like we play, we kid, we joke with the idea of God bless us for and no more. Right? Okay, so he came to the place that he realized that when he prayed the Siddur, that he could really feel what was coming out of the Siddur as he was praying. So when we pray, by no means think that you should not say to God what you feel in your heart. You absolutely should. Okay? And the some prayers, some rabbis absolutely promote you doing it in your own specific language, in the language that you can relate in. However, the Siddur, often they want you to try to pray as much in Hebrew as you possibly can, which is very, 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 very praiseworthy in the goal. Okay? Now, what I want to do is find my notes, and I want to look at this book. I hope I get to fasting. But there's something fascinating out of this particular book, the Siddur, the Art Scroll Siddur, the introduction, that I want you to see. Okay? Where it says, a prayer, a timeless need. Okay? Let's go on down to, and please, read all of this. I think it's very, very enlightening, and I think it's actually very helpful in prayer. And we're just going to cover a piece of this, so because of time, we can't cover everything, and that's why you have questions in your homeworks and questions that we ask in the other material. Okay. As a synonym for the human being, the Mishnah, which level?
Peshat,
very good. Problem, Bava Kama 2a, what's the problem?
Where it came from.
Where it came from, okay, but there's a problem with that statement.
That's a Talmud.
That's a Talmud, it is not a Mishnah.
Not a Mishnaic address.
Okay, it's not a Mishnaic address, very good, okay? However, what we'll notice when you do, the Mishnah will say like one and one. And chances are, I did not look up this particular Mishnah, but Bava Kamma 1:1. It'll probably be Bava Kamma 1:1. And how would I surmise that? Because it's got a Talmudic address, but the Talmudic address is 2a. So that means on page 2, folio A, or the first side. Okay? Imagine, you know, like a notebook in front of you, page A, page B. Okay? On the right hand side, right to left, you're reading, right? On the right hand side is A, on the left hand side is B. So if it's on folio A, it's on the right side. If it's folio B, it'll be on the left side. Okay? But he quoted the Gemara for this. But the reason this is okay still is because what he will do is the Gemara, the Talmud, will start off with the Mishnah. It will give the Mishnah as its core, and then what it will do is cite other rabbinic information in the rest of the Gemara, which is the second level, the Remez, right? But always it builds its Gemara on the Peshat. So it's really not a problem here. It just looks like it at superficially.